Who is paying particular attention to what is going on in Europe right now? We begin a series of conversations with people from Central and Eastern Europe whose homelands lie between Russia and Germany, and where the footprints of history still feel fresh and the bloody ghosts of the 20th century are easily stirred. When Vladimir Putin talks about territorial rights and protecting Russians in Crimea and Ukraine and Moldova, these people hear memories of invasions and violence. Our first voice comes from the Czech Republic, formerly Czechoslovakia, where the Soviets invaded in August of 1968. Prague native Michael Level says the Ukraine crisis has brought the year 1968 back for him in vivid color.
I was 17 when Russians came. And at that time, you know, at 17, we didn't travel abroad, so we didn't have too much of idea how it is in the West. And then it started to tower a little bit in 1968. Well, we were listening more of the West radio, and well, some books were coming in, so we learned a little bit what's happening, and we were curious. But then, you know, for another 23 years, it was basically stamped out. You couldn't travel, you couldn't read whatever you wanted. You were really limited in what you could do.
When you look at the people of Ukraine who profess anyway to feel a warm embrace of the West, or some sense that they really yearn for the kind of freedoms that you're talking about right there, do you believe, based on your experience, that those yearnings and the taste of being closer to the West can be simply shut off by the actions of a nation like Russia?
I don't think so, because, you know, we tasted it back here for, well, half a year, maybe a year in 1968. But they, in Ukraine, they tasted it for, almost 20 years. So they know the connection to the West is pretty real. And by the way, now there's internet, there's radio, there's TV. So you know what is happening. You cannot be completely cut off the information like back there in the 60s. So, yeah, it's very real.
And as far as the possibility that this could become a wider conflict, what do you think about that? Certainly historians are talking about, you know, this is a conflict that could, you know, raise the ghosts of World War I even. But from your perspective, is that overstating the case?
No, it's not overstating the case. I think that the Ukraine, they lost Crimea, and that hopefully is it. It will not go further. It can happen, but I'm hoping it's not happening. Unfortunately, the power of Putin is not very controlled by anything. It's just he doesn't care what the world thinks. He's just one of the new total absolutist rulers. The only big opposition inside of Russia might be the people who are very economically connected to the West, the oligarchs. But once you have a madman in the head, it's hard. It's uncontrolled power, which is the worst what can happen to any country in the world.
You're a chemist, and you know something about uncontrolled reactions. And
oh my God, yes.
What can sustain them, and what causes them to burn out? I mean, as you look around Europe, right around you, there are the remains of empires or nations that imagine themselves as an empire that are just skeletons, gone, you know, vanished. The Habsburgs, the Polish Empire from centuries ago, the Ottoman Empire that fell after World War I. Who's to say that Russia won't end up like that? And what will determine if, in fact, it goes the other direction? That Russia would restore its empire? As a chemist, what's going to keep this reaction going, and what's going to cause it to burn out?
Well, actually, I think that the economy is very important part of it. Russia is not very dispersed economy. It's very one-way oriented. It's oriented to the export of the oil and gas. If they would realize that there is a power in being like a conglomerate and have a common market, and they would be able to really make it powerful economic union, that would probably be much different Europe.
Michael Level, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Michael Level is a chemist and a 63-year-old citizen of the Czech Republic. All of the people we have been speaking to from Central and Eastern Europe say the ghosts of history in the lands that lie between Germany and Russia are suddenly alive. In the past few weeks, Vladimir Putin speaking of Russian territorial rights, Germany trying to reassure Belarus, Latvia, and Estonia. This is both a chilling irony and a vivid memory of a brutal 20th century history. We turn now once again to Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale University, author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. Welcome back to the program, Professor.
Very glad to talk to you.
The history of Europe between Germany and Russia goes back really to the 1930s. It goes back farther than that, but the brutal history that you describe in your book really begins in that period between 1931 and 1945. Can you remind us of what happened in that territory between Russia and Germany?
There are a couple of things that are worth remembering. I mean, we in America look at all this from a great distance, and when we think about history, we use big concepts like Hitler or like appeasement. But from the point of view of the people who lived in independent states in Europe, in Eastern Europe or Central Europe, the 1930s were a period when independence and nation statehood were chipped away at and destroyed. So one line of analogies that comes to the mind of people in Austria or Germany or Lithuania and Poland would be the Anschluss of Austria by Germany in 1938, the destruction of Czechoslovakia by Germany, which began with the annexation by Germany of a little bit of territory called the Sudetenland. Then you move to the joint German-Soviet invasion of Poland in 1939, which a lot of Poles remember in this connection with Russia today, because the argument that the Soviet Union used to invade Poland in 1939 was that the Polish state no longer existed. That's the exact same argument which Russian leaders make now about Ukraine, that despite appearances, there is no longer a Ukrainian state. And then, of course, in 1940, the Soviet Union occupied the Baltic states, who didn't put up a fight. And that's an analogy which a lot of people are thinking about in the Baltic region as well. You know, should the Ukrainians be ready to go to war? And then there's a second element, a much deeper, darker element, which is that in a very broad way, the lands between the Soviet Union and Germany in the 1930s were the places of a huge colonial competition between Nazi Germany and the Stalinist Soviet Union, in which all in all, something like 14 million human beings were killed. And in that period between 1933 and 1945, the absolute worst place to be of all was Ukraine. Something like half of the people who were killed, maybe a bit more, were actually killed in Ukraine, first as a result of Soviet policy and then as a result of German policy.
And we're not talking about soldiers who died in the conflict. We're talking about civilians who were put to death either by the Nazis or by the Soviets.
It's a great point. Something like 3 million people in Soviet Ukraine were starved to death. We're talking about children, women, and men in 1932 and 1933. Another several hundred thousand were killed in the Great Terror in the Soviet Union. And then all that is before the invasion of the Soviet Union by Germany. And the invasion of the Soviet Union is, of course, not an invasion of Russia. It's an invasion of the Soviet Union. And the Western Soviet Union is precisely Belarus and Ukraine. So the worst of the war, the worst of the German occupation was precisely in Ukraine. Another 5 or 6 million people are killed as a result.
Well, bearing in mind that brutal history and that level of killing that went on, can people listening to President Obama or the leaders of NATO saying, "We will defend you," can they be reassured given the history that you've just described?
On the one hand, there is a deep existential fear, the fear that comes from a very recent history of having your state destroyed, which most of us would have difficulty understanding. At the same time, it's precisely that existential fear which leads to the very rational political desire to belong to the West or to belong to a military alliance which promises protection. So naturally, this is a moment when people in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, countries that have tasted Soviet aggression but are now members of NATO, are wanting further assurances, are wanting troop presences. And it's also naturally a time when Ukrainians, who are the ones who are under the most direct threat right now, obviously, since part of their country has been invaded by Russia and Russian troops are on their eastern border, want to have closer cooperation with the West. We can't resolve these fears, but of course, it's sound policy to take them into account.
So the fear that you describe may be something remote to a Barack Obama, but it's certainly not remote to a Vladimir Putin. Do you see him deliberately playing on these fears and pulling these levers in his political calculus?
Yes, exactly. In fact, he's using, it's a triangle. I mean, he's using Barack Obama to try to increase these fears at the moment by going by. So the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, is speaking to the American Secretary of State, John Kerry, on a regular basis. And what this does, going over the heads of the Ukrainians or going over the heads of the East Europeans, is it revives the specter of some kind of diplomatic solution over the heads of the people involved, just like Munich and Czechoslovakia in 1938, or just like the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact between Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939, when states were destroyed without the consent and indeed without even the voice of the people who were most directly concerned. Putin is perfectly aware that these kinds of discussions with America terrify East Europeans. And if you read the Russian press releases, they're edited in such a way as to maximize these fears. The Russians keep suggesting that the Americans are about to sell them out, which is not true. At least I hope it's not true. But the continuation of Russian-American discussions about questions that are fundamentally internal Ukrainian questions, I think, is designed on the Russian side to create the impression in Ukraine that they're about to be sold out and that their future doesn't really exist.
So John Kerry comes back to Washington and says, hey, we're still talking. And people in Ukraine look at that and say, here we go again.
Well, I don't know what Kerry is telling the people in Kyiv, right? I mean, he may be offering very sound reassurances to his colleagues there as well about what he's saying to Lavrov. I wouldn't want to speak to that. But certainly that is a concern in Ukraine. And it's a concern which the Russians are very consciously trying to maximize. They're trying to present the Ukrainians as having no friends. It should be said, however, that American policy on other fronts has been quite reassuring to Ukrainians, at least in the last few weeks.
Timothy Snyder is professor of history at Yale University, author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. Thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.